Coming to you across the ether at the speed of light, it's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells of Preferred Financial and Carrie Deese, processor extraordinaire, keeping away those evil underwriters who want to turn your loan down. Join us for the next hour as we take a look at a host of miscellaneous issues and answer some listeners' questions as we navigate the mortgage process. Carrie, I'm thinking maybe I ought to begin the program with the confession that when it comes to Preferred Financial, you're really the one who runs the whole operation. I'm like the old Remington Steel guy, you know. I got my name up there, but in reality, we all know who makes this place run, and that's Carrie. So, guys, don't bother calling me. I'm just a figurehead. You need anything done, it's Carrie you want on your side. We're going to talk today about a lot of miscellaneous issues, and we're going to try to answer some questions that we get from our listeners and our clients on just a host of different issues. Mortgages and real estate are both complex transactions, and a lot of issues arise over the course of 30 years of doing business. I think there's that famous insurance company that says, "We've seen a lot, so we know a lot." And Carrie and I have both seen a lot.
Oh, yes.
So hopefully we know a lot, and we will help steer your way through the mortgage minefield. I want to start today with a topic that, while it may not be very pleasant, and I certainly hope you don't have to deal with it, it's one that we see just a host of mistakes made and a lot of heartache after the fact from the inability to transact a mortgage because the situation was not properly handled in the beginning. And that is, what do you do with mortgage matters when you're facing a divorce situation? So even though we don't like to talk about it, it's absolutely critical that you get this right if you are in the process of going through a divorce, if you're facing a divorce. After the fact, these things get tough, if not impossible, to completely fix. I want to say, first of all, that in a divorce situation, property distribution is not the same thing as debt distribution. And I also want to say that your divorce decree can say an awful lot of things, but what your divorce decree cannot do, no matter what it says, is undo or cancel a previous debt obligation that you entered into. If you want to think of it in these terms, if, for instance, you and your spouse jointly signed on a house and you're both on title and both of you jointly signed on the mortgage, when you're facing a divorce and if your divorce decree says, well, this spouse is going to be responsible for the mortgage payment in the future, that action by the divorce court cannot go back and undo the original contract that you signed saying you would be obligated to repay the mortgage. And it doesn't undo it. And that can lead to a lot of heartache. So the proper way of treating mortgage matters when going through a divorce become really critical. What you want to make absolutely certain in a divorce situation is not only in writing in the divorce decree itself, but in actuality after the divorce has finished. And that is, you need to be absolutely certain you have terminated all of your joint credit accounts. Carrie, what happens if you don't terminate a joint credit account?
Well, it stays joint, and if your former spouse is delinquent, so are you.
That's right. You are still on the account, and even though the divorce decree may say this spouse is responsible for the payment on this account, it doesn't matter. Again, you haven't canceled the original contract, and you cannot get that account out of your credit system. It's there, and if your spouse goes late on a payment, guess what? It's a blemish on your record. And no appeal to the court after that for what happened is going to undo the damage. So you want to terminate all joint credit accounts in a divorce situation. You want to make absolutely certain that the spouse who is receiving the property, and by that I mean the home or the homes, and if they are going to be responsible for the mortgage payment under the divorce decree, you want to make certain that they remove you from the mortgage debt. Now, Carrie, what is the only way you can get removed from mortgage debt? Do you just write up the lender and say, hey, drop me off of here?
Nope. You actually have to go through the full refinance process.
There is no other way, folks. Again, regardless of what the language says in the divorce decree, regardless of what the family court judge says, who's responsible, the only way to get off of the mortgage debt is for the spouse who is retaining the marital home to refinance the transaction. And in that refinance transaction, you can exit title, which you're supposed to do, but also, and more importantly, you will exit responsibility for that debt.
And just to reiterate, going off title is not the same thing as going off of the mortgage note.
That is correct. Property distribution has nothing to do with debt distribution. You have to handle these matters separately. And in many instances, you're doing both. You're exiting the property on title, but you also need to exit the debt responsibilities. We call these the ghosts that come back and haunt you and the plagues that come and get you, because you may be going to buy a house a year, 2 years later, only to find out that your credit has been wrecked because you did not take care of these things. So it's kind of like being held hostage. And here's the problem. If divorces are not always friendly situations, and so an ex-spouse may be more than happy to help you destroy your credit, and getting their cooperation after the fact is very difficult. So make sure with your attorney that you structure your divorce decree clearly to exit all debt and to exit title where is necessary so that these ghosts don't come back and haunt you. Now, in addition to your spouse being late on the payment that could affect your credit, if you were to remain on the account, just because your ex-spouse is paying that debt doesn't mean in the early goings that that debt won't be counted on your debt-to-income ratios when you go to apply for a mortgage. There's a waiting period that has to pass before we don't have to count that debt any longer. Carrie, what is that time that they have to wait?
You have to wait a year, so we'll need 12 months of definitive proof that someone else has been making that payment.
And Carrie, how do we prove that?
With canceled checks or bank statements.
And so if you and your ex-spouse are not on good terms, and you say to your ex-spouse, well, hey, I need to see 12 months canceled checks where you paid the mortgage so I can go get a house.
Yeah.
You might not get the cooperation.
Might not work out so well.
So far better, again, to cancel that debt, get your name off of the debt by making your spouse refinance the property so you can exit the mortgage obligation, so that you're not only haunted by a potential late payment, but you can go ahead and buy a house yourself without waiting the mandatory 12 months, where you can then not have to count that old mortgage debt in your ratios, but also we would have to get the canceled checks from a potential ex-spouse who is, you know, hurt or angry and doesn't want to give that to you. So save yourself a lot of headaches, and when you're going through your divorce, make sure you follow these suggestions that we made. Now, I had a listener question that came in, and they said, I want to buy out my spouse and keep my marital home. Can I cash out funds to buy out my spouse's equity? Carrie, are you allowed in a divorce settlement to refinance and cash out money to buy out your spouse?
You can, and you can actually go up to a 90% LTV instead of the standard 80% with a regular cash-out refinance.
So there's some leeway there to do a little bit more than you would normally be able to if the use of the cash-out funds is to cash buy out the equity of the ex-spouse, then yes, you can go to 90%. We'll finish up on a couple of divorce issues when we get back after the break. We'll talk about alimony and child support income and alimony and child support debt in the mortgage process. Join us after the break. thanks for joining us this morning. We've been talking about mortgage matters when you're facing a divorce. If you have any particular questions, if you're in the midst of this and would just like some personal advice, feel free to reach out to us. You can call me at 864-235-9596. Or if you prefer to just email a question, email me at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. In regard to divorce situations, two issues come up regarding alimony and child support. One question could be, am I able to count alimony and child support as qualifying income when I am either refinancing the house I'm keeping or I'm going to buy a new house due to a divorce? Carrie, how do the lenders treat alimony and child support as qualifying income?
We can use them as long as you've received them for 6 full months, and we can show those canceled checks or bank statements or direct account transfers showing that you have received those.
Okay, so the income can be counted. Mm-hmm. What other criteria are there that will allow it to be counted?
It does have to be court-ordered, and it has to continue for at least 3 more years.
Go ahead.
The divorce decree will say that for the alimony. The child support, it will also say that, and we have to prove that the child is no more than 15 or less than 15 years old at the time of loan closing.
Right. So as with all income, past receipt and future continuity are critical underwriting parameters. The past receipt is a 6-month history. The expected continuity is the 3 years. So the divorce decree has to state how long it will continue as far as alimony goes. Child support, we simply get identification showing the age of the child. And as long as they're under 15, that means the child support will continue 3 more years. And we can then count it. Now, on the flip side of that, Carrie, how does a lender look at alimony and child support payments that one of the spouses in the divorce is having to make and they want to apply for a mortgage? How do they treat alimony payments and child support payments?
Well, they're treated a little bit differently. Alimony is subtracted from your qualifying income because it's tax deductible. But child support is counted as a debt, which actually has a much greater impact on your debt-to-income ratio.
It does, and that can be restrictive in what you're able to do. Alimony, if you're making $100,000 a year and your alimony is $25,000, well, then your qualifying income is reduced to $75,000. Your debts remain the same. But if you're paying child support, whatever you're paying in child support is the same as any payment you might be making on an automobile or a revolving credit card. It goes in your debt column. And so it can have an impact on the capacity you have to purchase a home.
And you may think, well, what if I just don't mention that? They won't know either way. The underwriters do look at the payments that come out on the bank statement. So if you're paying it, they will ask about a payment that's not on your credit report, and they will find out either way. So it's best to just tell us up front.
Please tell us up front. We don't like surprises. And all of this is public record. Your divorce decree is a public record, so it's not that it's terribly hidden either. So lenders have ways of checking up on all those kind of things. If we know about them up front, we can help chart your way through those. If we get surprised, then we look like we participated in not revealing, and then we can't really help you. So all of these things, again, feel free to contact us. We'll talk them through with you, help you set them up, help make sure the language in your divorce decree is beneficial for you and your future housing needs. Let's move on to a more pleasant topic, Carrie. We get a lot of questions from borrowers about what the best way to finance renovations and repairs is. And boy, this is kind of one of those wide-ranging topics that can, the answers are always, well, it depends. So one of the approaches depends on the relative size of the renovation project you're doing. And think of it this way, at some point, a major renovation and addition project comes closer to looking like a construction project than it does just to, well, let me fix a few things up here. So you may go into a situation thinking, Well, I'll probably do this on an equity line because I'm only going to do this much work. But then you may find that the scope of the project that you end up with is such that the lender is going to want to have a little bit more control on the release of funds, that is, release the funds as work is done. And that's going to be a lot more like a construction loan. So it can be quite different, the product that we recommend to you. Where we can and when we can use a HELOC, that's a home equity line of credit, we do suggest using that for renovations and for improvements simply because it's very easy to do. It leaves all of the funds in your control. You can release money and pay for things as the work is done that is, you know, to your specifications and how you want it done. And it's also a relatively inexpensive loan type to set up. Whereas a standard fixed rate mortgage loan is going to run you $3,000 to $4,000 in net costs. Home equity lines are always going to be under $1,000 to get closed. And they give you a lot of flexibility. They also give you the option of making an interest-only payment for sometimes up to 10 years if you want to, and you can pay an equity line back and use it again. So home equity lines can be very convenient for doing renovations and for doing improvements. However, there's some disadvantages to an equity line that you just need to be aware of. They're all done on adjustable rates, and I would not say that this is a terribly big situation until your equity line gets to a higher loan amount. If you're looking at funds under $20,000-$25,000, even if under the adjustable rate the rates went up 2-4% more, you're only talking about an impact of $10, $20, $30 on your monthly payment. So an equity line that's small enough, the adjustable rate is not something to be worried about. However, we do find this, Kerry, that people who have equity lines who have the option of making an interest-only payment, that's generally what they tend to do. And so they don't end up amortizing the loan. They don't end up paying the principal down. And they can turn around 3, 4, 5 years later, and their equity line is right where it was in the years prior.
Right.
And they really haven't paid it down. So sometimes the discipline of having to pay a loan down is a good thing. And again, Kerry, with renovation projects, there are two approaches in value to the house. What two approaches might a lender take towards a renovation project on the front end?
Well, you may not be able to use an equity line if the present value of the home, which is considered unimproved, doesn't give you enough equity. If you have enough equity, obviously you can do an equity line. If you need to use the future value or what we call the improved value, then interim financing might be the only way you can go.
Yeah, the construction type product you may have to use if your future value, you have to use the future value as the basis of borrowing money. Kerry, how can you get a handle on the future value of your home after you've done all the improvements when you haven't done them yet?
Well, the appraiser will look at the plans and specs and compare that to other completed projects to come up with a value.
And what do they call that type of appraisal?
A subject to appraisal.
And that means the appraiser says this house is worth this much money subject to these improvements being made.
Right.
Once these improvements are made. So, and that's kind of a good guideline too, because in the course of doing improvements to a home, you don't always get every dollar back in value that you put into a house. For instance, and I think we mentioned this in another program, you might put a brand new roof on a house and that may cost you $8,000 to do, but that does not necessarily translate back to $8,000 in increased value in your home. So when you're looking at a home improvement project, you may want to do a subject to appraisal just to know if the improvements you've chosen to do are going to pass the value back to you in the house. When we do have to use a subject to value, an improved value, we're looking at a construction type loan. And a construction type loan, the only difference is that the funds are approved up front, so you know you've got the funds to do the improvements, but they're only released in part as the work is done. Usually they're set up on monthly draws. They'll send an inspector out to make sure the work is done. They will not generally release funds for materials to be purchased. They will only release funds for work that is completed. Now, interim financing, construction financing, is short-term financing. It's going to be in place for a year or less. It, too, is an interest-only product that you just pay interest-only. But in the end, we have to wrap up that construction loan back into permanent loan financing. So in addition to getting the construction-type loan, you also have to close a refinance loan at the end to get the permanent fixed-rate financing you need. Carrie, we get listener questions in regard to renovations and improvements. So, we had one come in. What was that one that they had asked?
They wanted to buy a foreclosed house that was in not very good condition. What kind of financing can they get for that?
That one is really common. Of course, a foreclosed home can be a real bargain, but there's a reason it's a bargain, and that is that financing is rather difficult to obtain on a foreclosed property because they are rarely in good condition. There's a test that every house has to pass in order for your permanent financing to be closed on, and it is called marketability, or it is in the opinion of the appraiser whether the house is in current marketable and livable condition. So when you're looking at a foreclosed home, and we've seen some real disasters, I mean, sometimes people tear out the light fixtures when they go. Sometimes they rip up carpet to take with them when they go, and a house can be in really bad shape. So it's difficult to get the permanent financing you need because of the condition of the house on the day you buy it. You may even have the money in hand to fix it up, but Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will not close on that until the house is in a livable condition. There is one program for homeowners that can bridge this, and that's called the FHA 203K loan. It will finance both the purchase and the renovations with some restrictions. We'll go over those restrictions when we get back off the break and talk about the 203K loan. It's an increasingly popular loan, a bit of a paperwork nightmare, but we can get you through it if you want to go in that direction. Join us after the break.
Welcome back. Hope you've got your cup of coffee. We are talking about some miscellaneous questions this morning. As always, if you have questions about anything, you can call us Monday through Friday at 864-235-9596, or you can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And if you want to catch up on a past show, they are all up on our website at preferredfinancialgreenville.com.
Thanks, Carrie. We were talking about purchasing a foreclosed home, a home that is not in good condition, and we had mentioned that for someone who's going to occupy the home being bought, that the FHA 203K program is it's really the only bridge-type program that will both fund the purchase and the renovations. Let's talk about some of the features of the FHA 203K. First of all, the things that it will not do. And that is, an FHA 203K will not cover or allow for any structural work to be done. What is the nature, Carrie, of structural work that would be excluded?
Anything to do with the foundation or the support system of the home.
And that's correct. And that's to the extent that you cannot even remove a wall because that's a structural member of the house. So it can be a little bit restrictive because it doesn't allow for structural work, but for general improvements, energy efficiency improvements, cosmetic improvements, replacing damaged parts of the house, appliances, funding a new heating and air system, a new roof, it can be an excellent program. There are some dollar restrictions on this program. Carrie, We try to stay under what figure with this 203K as far as the renovation costs go?
$35,000.
Okay, and what happens when we go to $35,001?
Well, the paperwork doubles, and you have to employ a HUD renovation counselor.
Dum, 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 dum. A HUD renovation counselor is required. Don't attempt this at home, folks. Leave this to your professionals. No, you probably, in the first place, will not need more than $35,000 in renovations, or you probably have a very heavily damaged house. But when you go through the process of hiring a HUD renovation counselor, it also involves getting multiple quotes for each aspect of the work you're going to do. All of this has to be cleared through the counselor. And what, let me put it this way, a normal FHA loan, Carrie, just a straight purchase, no renovation, how long does it take us to get one of those closed these days?
Oh, 30, 45 days.
Okay, so we're basically on a good turnaround for those. When we throw the regular 203K loan, where the renovations are under $35,000, where would you say we fall on that one?
About 60 days.
About 60 days. If we throw a HUD counselor in there, well, I won't even mention the last one we did. How long were we with that loan in Edgefield?
Oh, my. Probably 6 months. I mean, it had some extraneous issues.
It did. I mean, they had some structural issues, and we had to back out completely, let the seller get the structural issues done, and then go back in. But my goodness, that was a marathon.
And what they require from the contractors is so incredibly specific. So sometimes you go back and forth for several weeks before you get it exactly the way HUD requires it.
So we're glad to help you with any of these programs, the regular FHA, the 203K, and even we will tackle the HUD counselor with you if you have to. And in fact, the couple in Edgefield just got a stunning house.
Oh, they did.
Oh, my goodness. It was incredible. It was worth the six-month wait, but make sure if you're going to go over $35,000 that you have a lot of time on your hands and the seller understands this is not going to go through quickly, and it's going to take a little bit of time to do. Ultimately, with the 203K, Carrie, how much of the purchase price and the renovations will this program cover?
96.5%.
Well, that's pretty huge. So, like, you could have a $100,000 house, and you're going to put $25,000 in improvements in it, and you're saying that the FHA is going to finance almost 97%. You're only going to have 3.5% of the $125,000 in it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And that's good. So this can be a real lifesaver in these situations. You might have the patience to pick up a good value and go through the renovation process to get what you want. It's a bit of a paperwork nightmare, so you'll just have to be patient when you're going through it. We'll step you through it and help you with it. The 203K loan, if you're going to occupy the house, you cannot use this program if you're an investor. So if you are an investor who's looking to purchase a home, either that needs to be fixed up and renovated so that you can either turn around and rent it or you can turn around and flip it, again, we're looking at a very difficult loan type to do. It's kind of like that loan that you go down to the bank and they say, well, if you got $1 million in our bank, we'll be glad to lend you $500,000. And other than that, it can be very difficult. Now, again, this is why foreclosures and what we call distressed properties can be such values, because not everyone can go in and buy these things. It takes a special investor with financial strength, with really good credit scores, with reserve liquidity to go in, buy a house, fix it up, and then convert it to a rental property to hold or to flip it and sell. These are more banking-type institutional loans. We do have sources for them. They're normally limited to 70% of the purchase price plus the renovation. So quite the opposite from the homeowner 203K loan, you're going to need about 30% of the purchase price plus 30% of the improvements you're going to do in hand, in cash, to get this done. The only exception to that is a loan type that we call hard money. Hard money really kind of disappeared off the landscape after 2007, but has come back, and we do have lending sources. Hard money is, I guess it's that because it's hard to get financing for these properties. Maybe that's why they call it hard money. It is at a much higher interest rate. These interest rates can run 8 to 12%. And the benefit, though, is they will finance a higher percentage of the project. And they don't worry too much about the financial and credit condition of the investor. They're looking more at the property itself to leverage the loan. In other words, they're only going to lend you enough so that if you don't make it, and it doesn't sell for what you thought it was going to sell for, or when you thought it was going to sell for, and you get stuck, they're not going to get stuck. They'll be happy to take the house back from you at the amount of money they borrowed, that they let you borrow from them. So a hard money is kind of a last option in most cases for investors. But sometimes for beginning and early investors, this is the way you have to go to get the first few under your belt so that you can move on from there. Kerry, we'd like in the closing sections of our program just to maybe answer some questions that have come in from our listeners, have come in from our clients that can benefit the general audience. We've got some questions here. What have we got on the plate?
I'm buying a house that's worth a lot more than I'm paying for it. Can I use that equity as part of the down payment?
Wow, that is a question we get all the time. So I've agreed to pay $150,000 for this home, and it appraised for $200,000, so can't I use that $50,000 as down payment? What's the answer, Kerry?
No.
And is the answer yes for anybody?
No.
No. The answer is no. So you want an answer? The answer is no. That's a no. All lending sources, FHA, VA, Fannie, Freddie, USDA, no one will let you count equity as down payment except...
Nobody.
The answer is no, except in one situation. There's one situation in which this can be done, and that's a non-arm's length transaction. The only time that the equity can be considered your down payment is if your parents or your brother or your sister or a near blood relative is selling you their house for less than what it's worth, then you can use the equity for down payment. But why is the reason you can use it in that case?
Well, because it's treated as a gift.
That's right. That's the only reason. It's not really, that you're using the equity per se.
Right.
It's just the equity is being given to you and gifts are allowed for down payment. But other than that, the answer is
no.
No. 100% of the time. Kerry, we had a listener who asked, can I close on a house and then turn around immediately to get that equity out? So I've only paid $150, but it's worth $200. So, hey, I'll buy it. Then I'll just turn around and cash money out. Can I do that?
Not so much.
Okay, we got another no?
No.
Another no. And this no means it's like a definite maybe, right?
No.
No, it's probably, but not necessarily?
No.
Maybe so, maybe not?
No.
No, it's no.
It's just no.
Okay. You can eventually, but you cannot do it right away. So any refinance loan is going to be limited to what you paid for it during the first 12 months you own the house. After 12 months, you're able to look at the appraised value, and yes, you can then cash equity out. But before 12 months, you're restricted to the original purchase price, no matter what the appraisal said. Home stretch with answers to your questions about mortgage lending, covering a bunch of topics today and some common questions that we get out there in our listening audience. If we aren't addressing your question, feel free to email us at themortgagemoment.com. I'm sorry, themortgagemoment@gmail.com. Or just pick up the phone. That's the easy way. 864-235-9596. A real human being will answer the phone. You know, we said
probably
that.
Probably me.
And then, yeah, that's right. And then we bought a brand new phone system that was shunning people off into voicemail for a while. I think we got that all under control,
it's
right?
It's finally fixed, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Don't ever fix what's broken, right? That's my motto. That's why everything we have is ancient.
Don't ever fix what's broken? You mean, what's not broken?
Fix what's not broken. There you go. I think I'm broken. All right, so we were talking about the question that a listener had asked, can I close on a house and turn around and cash the equity out of it? And we mentioned that for the first 12 months you own a house, you cannot do that. You're restricted in your valuation to what you paid for it, no matter how high the appraisal was. Again, with all the nuances in lending, it's why there's never a definite answer without some exception somewhere. There's an exception to this rule. If you have purchased a house and you have done extensive additions and renovations on a scale that is more than 30 to 40% of the value of the house that you bought, you are allowed after 6 months to declare that to have been a construction project and refinance based on the new improved value. We don't often see that. It's the only exception to being able to get equity out without having to wait a full year to use the appraised value to do so. Carrie, I have a listener that asked, do I have to sell my current home before I buy another home? Is a lender going to call the new home my primary residence, the old home I'm leaving my primary? How do we do that, and can I do that?
Well, you can retain your current home and buy a new home as long as you can afford to carry both house payments.
So they're going to count both mortgage payments in my debt ratios if
right.
I do that.
Right.
You got to be able to carry both homes just in case the other house doesn't sell for a while.
And you need to be able to prove that the new house will be your primary residence.
Okay. And how do you go about proving to a lender that you're actually going to live in that new house? Because here's one loan fraud that gets perpetrated on lenders. Somebody says they're going to buy a house to move into. They really don't intend to do it. They just intend to get a owner-occupied interest rate and then turn around and rent the house out. So what does a lender look for as proof that this new home you're buying is really going to be your primary residence?
Well, if you're a family of five and you're purchasing a two-bedroom house...
and leaving your four-bedroom house.
Right. That might not seem too logical. However, if you were a family of five, but you've just had three kids go off to college, and you're downsizing, that makes perfect sense.
So the narrative can be part of the explanation.
Absolutely.
The lender. What are you doing? And downsizing always requires an explanation.
Right.
Because the lenders want to make sure, hey, this is really going to be owner-occupied, or you just pulling our leg here.
Right.
Now, if you, what else do you have, can you do to show that this is going to be your primary residence, the new house that you're buying? That's pretty definitive to a lender that you mean it, that you're going to sell your old home.
If you go ahead and list it on the MLS system with a realtor.
Old home.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. So one of the ways to clear the air here is to put your current home up for sale and show the listing, MLS listing number to the lender, so that they know, yes, you really are selling this house. That's not always possible. I had one the other day who asked, they said, I don't really want to put the house on the market yet because I want to fix some things up first. And again, with a reasonable explanation, and usually if you're going from a smaller house to a bigger house, it's not really questioned very often.
Right.
You know, you're improving or increasing the size. It's in the downsizing or maybe the lateral move that we really need to really make sure that the story is right and that you are moving. Whatever, what other questions, Carrie, can we answer for some of our listeners?
Can I hold or transfer my primary residence into a trust for or estate for tax purposes?
Big question. Now, with some of the recent changes in the tax laws, estate planning is not as critical as it was. Boy, there was a time 2 years ago where we had a $1 million estate exemption that then was supposed to go to $2 million, but then Congress didn't pass the law, so it went to zero, and we had about 3 or 4 months where if you died, you were really stuck there. But now they've increased it from the $2 million to, I believe, $5 to $7 million. So not everyone needs to use this technique, but where you do need to put your real estate in a trust in order to do estate planning for tax purposes, the good news is that you are allowed to hold your primary residence in certain types of trusts. Now, the general category of this type of trust is called a revocable trust. That's a trust that can be undone by the people that did it. There are irrevocable trusts, and you cannot do that. That's where you transfer the disposition of the property to a third party, and you cannot yourself undo the trust. Those are not allowed, but almost every estate planning type of trust is a revocable trust. They're sometimes called inter vivos revocable trusts. They're called living trust. We used to hear them under the old estate rules as A-B trusts. That is a transfer from the deceased to party A and later to party B. All of these can be used as long as the trust is a revocable trust. Carrie, they will require a copy of that trust, I believe. And the underwriter's legal department, don't they have to review that?
They do.
And they just have to make sure it is an allowable trust, but it can be done. I get this question from, we got a lot of self-employed borrowers in our listening area, and we get this question quite a lot. I want to buy a house jointly with my wife, but you know, I own my business. And even though I'm incorporated, I'm a little bit afraid of liability that might pass through my corporation to me. And I'm personally liable, so I want to get the house out of my name. We actually have a lot of doctors who ask this question, a lot of medical professionals. Because of potential liability claims, they want the house sheltered from that, and they ask, can I buy the house jointly, but then can I just put it in her name? What's the answer to that, Carrie?
You can file a simple quitclaim deed transferring your share of the title to her.
So it is allowable, but how about at the point of purchase? Do I have to go on the title to begin with?
You do.
Yeah. If you're on the mortgage, you have to be on the title. But going on the title initially with your spouse, you can turn around literally the day after that is recorded and exit title under what is known as a quit claim deed. Quit claim deeds are relatively inexpensive to do. $150, $175 for the attorney to draw it up, $25, $30 to record it, and then you have departed from title without having departed the mortgage. Any real estate attorney can execute this for you, and you certainly may want to do this as a means of sheltering yourself from any potential liability. Carrie, what other questions have we gotten?
I own a beach house that I use myself, but rent it out to help carry the costs. Does the fact that I rent it out mean that I can't refinance it as a second home?
That's a good question. And the answer to this one is if your CPA is good at checking a box, you're okay.
Right.
If they aren't good at checking the right box, then you have kind of shot yourself in the foot. On your second home, you are allowed by the IRS and you're allowed by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the lenders to use that second home for yourself, but also to receive rental income from it. But the key as to deciding, is this really a second home or is this just a rental investment property, is the number of days that you hold the house for personal use. The IRS defines a second home as a home in which you retain the property for at least 15 days of the calendar year for personal use. Now, that means you can't enter into a 12-month lease because you've just blocked yourself out of those 15 days. The IRS is immediately going to count this as an investment property for tax purposes. Also, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are going to do the same thing. They're going to say this is no longer a second home. This is a rental home. So there's a little box on your Schedule E where your CPA or you would report the rental income from a second home, and you check that box stating that you retain the house for 15 days out of the year for your personal use, at least 15 days for your personal use. If you check the box, you can refinance this as a second home. Fannie and Freddie will allow it, and it will sail right through. If the box is not checked, you will be stymied, and then if you try to file an amended tax return, the lender will know that you filed the amended return, and they'll just assume you did that to get a second home classification, and they will not give it to you. So make sure your accountant gets that straight every year. If you intend to refinance that rental home. Now, sometimes you have fewer limitations on that home from a tax standpoint. You have better write-offs if it's rental property. And you may have to choose between the rock and the hard place there. But if you're planning to refinance that second home anytime in the next 2 years, make sure the little box is checked. Carrie, we have a lot of borrowers and buyers who are paid biweekly, and they want to set up their house payment on a biweekly payment. They have heard from this that they may be able to cut a number of years off their mortgage by changing to a biweekly payment. But the lenders charge $350 to do it, and they want to know, well, should I do this? Should I pay the $350 and set up a biweekly payment so that I knock about 7 years off my 30-year mortgage? Or what should I do? Well, what's your advice?
It's definitely a good idea. If you make a biweekly payment, you're actually making 26 half payments a year, which is the same as making 13 monthly payments.
That's right. So you got a choice. If it's convenient, the $350, and they draft the payment every 2 weeks, and you just want it that way for cash flow reasons, set up, do the $350. But if you want to accomplish the same thing on your own, take your current payment, divide it by 12, and just add that to each monthly payment, and you'll accomplish it the same way without spending the $350. Either way, the interest savings are enormous. On a $100,000 loan, you will save $47,000 over the life of that loan just by making that extra payment a year, 12th on a month at a time. Thanks for joining us this morning. You've been with Mark Wells and Carrie Deese on The Mortgage Moment. See you again next Saturday, bright and early.